Accession number 20272, Reel 3.
Major Sands, Reel 3. Yeah. Now, I think that one of the jobs you did after the war was the Malayan Emergency.
Yes.
Can you tell me what rank and job you had with the Hampshires at that time?
Yeah, I was company commander, major, company commander of Z Company. Well, it was D Company at those days, D Company. I should explain that in the 1st Battalion, the companies were A, B, C, D, and in the 2nd Battalion, they were W, X, Y, Z. But the 2nd Battalion had been disbanded, and so the companies were called A, B, C, D. We of the 2nd Battalion were not happy with this, and we managed, and the commanding officer of the 1st Battalion also had been a 2nd Battalion chap, and he got it changed to A, B, Y, Z, so that both battalion letterings are in one battalion. So I became officer commanding D Company in Wardibung Camp in Kuala Lumpur, Malaya.
How had you got to Malaya in the first place?
Oh, we went by troop ship. Marvellous. We went from Liverpool. I didn't go with the battalion. The battalion was already there. I was a reinforcement. And we went, Rosemary, my wife, and my two daughters and I, went by troop ship, the Empire Orwell. Was it the Empire Orwell? No, was it? Not the Opinia. No, that was Jamaica. We went by troop ship to Singapore. 3 weeks took us. And then we went by train up country to Kuala Lumpur and joined the battalion. D Company. I did the usual things. I went on a company commander's course. What the hell was that done? That was done in the south, I can't remember, somewhere. And then the battalion, we were the Kuala Lumpur battalion, Kuala Lumpur being the capital, which you know. And things were quiet in our area. But down in Johor, the bandits were becoming a bloody nuisance, and so the battalion was flown down to Johor, and D Company went, and then we were given an area in the jungle which we had to patrol and try and get out of these chums who were in there, these Indians, Chinese, whatever they were. And it was while I was we had 6 weeks down there when absolutely nothing happened. The only thing of interest was that the battalion, Y Company, oh, it was Y Company. Oh, it must have gone by Z by then. I thought I was D. Y Company captured two baby tigers. We were known as the Tigers, the Hampshires, because we got a tiger in our cat badge, which goes back to the old days of India. And we got these two tigers, and the problem was to know what to do with them. The Sultan of Johor wasn't at all happy, apparently, with people pinching animals from his state and taking them out of the state. So a plan was evolved whereby the tigers were given a shot in the arse by the doctor, and which put them out. And then they were put into wicker baskets and labelled mess silver. And the transport officer of the battalion, or it might have been the assistant adjutant, I'm not sure which, took them up on the night train to Kuala Lumpur, where they, this is, I'm not joking, where they were put up in the officer's mess. Now, while all this was going on, the CO sent a message to all companies asking if they had anybody who was a lion or a tiger trainer. I had Private Brick, whose father had been a lion tamer, and Brick said he knew a bit about it, so I sent a signal to the CO saying I got Brick, and he sent back and said, march him out. Marching out, you couldn't just walk out of the jungle, you had to go out escorted. So about seven or nine chaps escorted Private Brick out, and Brick went up to Waterburn Camp in Kuala Lumpur, where he became Tiger Major Brick, responsible for the two tigers, baby tigers. And they grew and they grew. Well, Lady Bourne, who was the wife of General Bourne, who was the commander and chief in Malaya at the time, expressed a wish to see the tigers. And she was allowed, the press was kept right out of this because we didn't want it to be known and anything about the tigers. And she asked if she could take a tiger in her arms and it just had a little nip. And it was no. Anyway, that went all right. And then the problem came to get rid of the tigers. I mean, they were getting so bloody big. Well, it so happened that the wing commander flying had been at school with me, Peter Le Cheminot, who became Air Chief Marshal Peter Le Cheminot, governor, Lieutenant Governor of Guernsey later on. But he and I had been Elizabeth College together. He'd gone to Cranmore when I went to Sandhurst, funny enough. And so I was detailed off by the CO to go and see him, which I did. And Peter said there'd be no problem. He said, we'll fly him down to Singapore, and then we'll get put him on a plane for England. And so they got in touch with BOAC, and the tigers duly went, and they went to the London Zoo, and one died. They had names, Rose, oh, I can't remember, the CO gave him a couple of names, and that was the story of the two tigers. But after that, it was realised that the Johor bandits were not for us, really. Oh, I know what had happened, because in our absence in KL, I call them bandits, because we always call them bandits, were knocking off the tappers in the rubber. And, of course, that was demoralising, you see. They were doing what they could to upset everything. And so the battalion went back to Kuala Lumpur, but this time it split into various company groups. And my company, with B Company and D Company, went to Kajang, which is a village about 9 miles away to the south of KL. And there we started a food denial operation, whereby all these villages in the area were all wired off. And the idea was to stop these bandits in the jungle getting at food and getting information. Well, not so much information, but getting food. Because they'd do anything to get food. They used to, the tappers used to fill their bicycle frames with rice and all sorts of things they used to get up to. And what we did, we had to patrol these villages to stop them coming to the village. We had to stop these tappers taking the food out to them. And once we got that done properly by all sorts of odd methods we had to do it, anyway, it meant that the bandits had to come to the food as opposed to the food going to them. And then we would ambush around the villages. Well, this was a sore, I mean, this was a, well, I suppose it was okay. We got a couple of bandits once through that business, but they were caught and shot. But nothing else was happening till one day the special branch officer came to see me. I was the senior company commander of the two in this camp. So I was really the OC of the setup in Kajang, in a girls' school. And he said he'd like some troops. So I said, how many? He said, well, he said, I got information that there are 17 bandits in a camp on a training course north of Kajang. And he said, we'd like to have them eliminated. So I went back, we had in the camp at the time three platoons of the six. There were three platoons each company, but we had three out on doing these anti-food operations, food denial operations. And we had three who'd done it, were retraining in the camp, doing a bit of shooting and keeping fit, so that two were from B Company and one from D Company. I had four, six, and ten platoons. Ten was mine, four and six for B. And as I was the senior of the two company commanders, I thought it was up to me to go and command this operation against this gang of 17 bandits in the jungle, right? And it was going to be done that night. But that evening, we'd organized a drinks party in the officers' mess to win the hearts and minds, a great phrase, of the locals. And it was the problem was to conceal the operation from these chums in case. Well, you never knew. I mean, they could easily go leave the party, ring up or do something, get in touch with this lot. You never knew who was on what side. But the commanding officer came down to this party, and at the party I explained to him that we had this operation. He said, I want you to run it, Jim. I said, well, I'd already decided I would do it. He said, never mind. He said, you're the senior, you will do it. And he said, what do you want me to do? What support do you want from the battalion or anybody else? So I said, well, what I want is some police vehicles. I said, if I go out in these 3-ton lorries we've got here, what we'd made the plan. What was going, we were, shall I show you the map? I had two platoons only in the camp. The third one was at a village called Cheras. But it was interesting that it was, Cheras is a little village that was on the route that we were going to take to get to this bandit camp, which was...
Don't bother with the map. Put it into words.
Which was at near Ulu Langat. And the plan was to go out in these buses, not to go up to Ulu Langat, because in the middle of the night, the sound of a British Army lorry would carry for some considerable distance, and the bandits would probably hear. So what we decided to do, there was a bridge over the river north of us, where we reckoned that we could cross that bridge and head for the camp. But the information was so poor, I was having doubts as to whether we would ever find it. But fortunately, the police, the special branch, had a bandit they captured who actually knew the location of this camp and had been in it. So they offered him as a guide, so I took him. We left Kajang after the party, I suppose, probably about, I don't know, 10:30 that night. And we debussed near the village of Cheras, where we picked up the platoon at Cheras, and then we debussed, went over a rickety bridge, which we were going two at a time, but it was so broken down, we had eventually to go single file only. We had a dog with us as well, but that was a tracker dog. And we didn't make much progress because the country there was appalling. And we got, I think at about 2 a.m., I decided the time had come to have a halt. So we just lay down where we were, and we had 2 or 3 hours sleep. Then we brewed up a meal. I should say that I said nobody would take any cigarettes at all with them. We'd taken all sorts of precautions. We'd taken all the metal caps off the water bottles, for example. Nobody would smoke. Nobody would wash in the streams because the soap suds traveled, say, 400 yards. We didn't know anything. I took every precaution I could to ensure that, of course, nobody ever spoke other than in whispers. We set off the following morning. This chap would come with me. I also had a police inspector there. This bandit, he didn't exactly know where he was, and so I sent Len Chandler, who was my second in command, out of the Ulu, the rubber, because that's where we were in rubber, to see if he could find out where we were. And he came back and he told me where we were. He'd taken a compass bearing or two on things that he could see and relate to the map. And we set off to climb through secondary jungle. Secondary jungle is stuff which has been cut, which means it's as thick as hell. Primary jungle is easier to deal with. And we marched, and we were doing about 500 yards an hour, I suppose. And after marching, and we had one incident with a hornet, hornet's nest, but fortunately we didn't get stung. They were a bit tedious, hornets. And we marched on and went on, and George, oh, we called the bandit George, because he was an automatic pilot. George got to a cross tracks, which he said, aha, he said, I know where I am. He said, the camp is over there. And so it was getting late, it was about 3 p.m. by then. You see, it gets dark very early in the in Malaya, and also in the jungle, it's not very light. So I made a decision that we would stop where we were for the night. Now, I could have gone in, but the thing was that the only way to deal with this camp was to surround it. And that's where George was going to come in very useful later, because he knew the layout of the camp and he knew the exits from the camp. If we'd been going by ourselves, I mean, we'd been hopeless. But he said it was going to take 2 hours to put a complete cordon in around this camp. And that's why I couldn't go that evening. I had wireless silence, by the way. and I wouldn't take any messages and I wouldn't send any. George said he had 2 hours to put the cordon in, but not before the following morning. So I said, right, boys, we stop here. I then briefed the platoon commanders on what we were going to do the following day. And briefly, what it was, 4th and 6th platoons were going to go into the cordon, as directed by George, and 10th platoon was going to come with me to do the assault on the camp, going into the cordon. The following morning at 9 o'clock, I'd sent a couple out to see if they could find that camp, if they could hear anything. And they came back, Len Chandler and one other came back, and my Batman, I think it was, came back and said, yes, they could hear the sound of chopping. And so I went with, I went with somebody or other, and we went above the camp and listened. And we saw one woman, so we knew there was at least one woman, but we didn't know much about these chaps, except we did know that the boss man was a very senior member of the Communist Party. While we were putting the cordon in, it started to rain. And it was the best thing that could have happened, because it covered all sounds we made. I mind you, I threatened anybody that made a noise, they would have a month's pay deducted from their account. And because I'm like that, I make these decisions and I can't keep them, because the only person who made noise while getting into position was me. Anyway, we got to, George put the 2 platoons into position and then came back and reported with his guard, that everything was okay. I had a couple of police inspectors as well with me. They were there for documents and things like that later on. And so at about midday, I got 10 platoon in a line by me when I gave the order for them. We had to go down a hill and up a little bit like that, and the camp was right in front of us in the trees. Not that we could see anything much, but we knew it was there because we'd heard the sounds. And there were meant to be sentries both at the north end and the south end. There's the camp there, right? In actual fact, there was no sentry at the north end, and there was no sentry at the south end when we actually did it. We don't know why. So we went down this slope, and at the bottom, I yelled out, charge! And we slithered up this next slope into the camp, because it was all mud. It was a track that led down to their water point, and of course it had been used. And I went flat on my face in the mud with Private Goodenough. I'll never forget him, with his foot pushing my face back. Anyway, I got out of it. We went into the camp. We were firing then at nothing. We were just firing. We had the self-loading rifle, so we were issuing bullets all over the place. In a way, it worked, because it alarmed the bandits in the camp, and they went out on their exit route straight into 4th and 6th platoon. And they were all killed except two. A girl who was injured got shot in the leg, and a chap, I don't know what happened to him, I think he was injured as well. Anyway, we had 11 we had 11 dead bodies straight away. And so I sent a message. By that time, it was absolute chaos, as you can appreciate, in the camp. There were documents, there were weapons, there were all sorts of things all over the place. I sent a message out to the CO, and all I said was, I have two. At that time, we hadn't found this 13th chap. We'd got the girl. We got 11 dead and one girl. I said, I have figures 1, 2. That's all I said over the air. Because that's the army way of saying 12, isn't it? When it got to the CO's operator in Kuala Lumpur, he read it as, I have figures 1 or 2. So he told the commanding officer that I had figures 1 or 2. And the CO thought, I don't know what he thought. He then got on the air to me and said, I understand that you have figures 1 or 2. I said, no, Colonel. I said, I have, or Sunray, or whatever we call them in those days. I have figures 1, 2. Dead. No, 11 dead. That's a 1-1 dead and 1 wounded. Female. Oh, he said, different. What can I do to help you? I said, I've got to get him out. And I said, one thing I am not allowing, Colonel. I mean, I didn't call him Colonel, but I mean, he knew. I'm not allowing my men to carry anybody anywhere. I said, it's a long march for them to bring these bodies out. Therefore, I need at least 50 people to come and carry all the weapons and documents and the bodies that I've got here. And he said, I want to talk to you, Jim. Well, no, he didn't say Jim. He said, meet me at Ulu Langat. So I went with a section. It was getting dark at that time, but we had enough light to get down to Ulu Langat, where I met him, and he got us all a bottle of beer, and then we made more arrangements. That's right. That's when I confirmed all this other stuff. And then I went back, and being me, I lost my way. Back to the camp. But there was a drill that if you lost your way in the jungle, you should always fire 3 shots in the air and in wait, and that the people who were in that you were going to your own camp would fire 3 shots in return and say, you work your way. I mean, I was the laughing stock of the whole bloody lot. I got back, and then I said, right, we'll all go to sleep now. I just left a few sentries around. I beg your pardon, that's right. I took with me, that was the time, yes. I took with me all these chaps who were going to carry out the bodies. And we all settled down, the camp, my company of about 100 men, and, I had 3 platoons, yes, I suppose, something. And these 50, 60 bodies we had who were going to do the carrying, and the extra police that came in with me to guard them and so on. I mean, it was an absolute shambles. When I woke in the morning, there was bad news that a hell of a lot of the documents had been captured and disappeared. What had happened was they were sympathizers, communist sympathizers amongst the gang that had come in. And the police were mad with this because a lot of intelligence had gone from Burton. Anyway, we marched them out, and I don't know what happened to them. The girl, I think, was tried, and I think she was executed or shot or something. Then Salip, who was the other, he was a very important guy, but number two was the chap that we hadn't picked up. I sent in a platoon the next day with dogs. My dog, the dogs I'd had, they'd been useless. And they found Salip near the camp and brought him out, and that was the end of that. It was the biggest operation by a British unit of years. But I always maintained that the reason it was successful that I had Hampshire National Servicemen. They were nearly all servicemen, these chaps.
Why should that have made a difference?
Well, because they're such splendid soldiers, that's why. I felt in my blood that these chaps were just the people I wanted.
Because they were Hampshires or because they were National Service?
Both. I mean, it's looked upon as quite a thing, this little thing. But I've written in there what I thought about it.
And you took dogs in, did you?
Yeah, I took dog, yeah. I think I had one. I had one tracker dog. But either one or two trackers. I can't remember.
But
I wrote this some years ago, by the way, so my memory is...
They didn't work very well.
No, they didn't. No, they didn't. Not. No, they didn't. Don't know why. But they did the following... When the other platoon went in the following day, that was the Pioneer platoon, I think, went in. Jim Kelly, yeah.
What was the demeanour of the girl that you found?
Oh, she was a first-class little shit. One of my platoon commanders said she'd been wounded in the leg. He captured her, and he said that he thought he should bandage in the thigh. He thought he should bandage it up. So I said, okay. John Bretherton, he's dead now. and she spat at him. Ooh. God, yeah, she was terrible. She really was out and out commie. Mm-hmm. I could see her point of view. Having been a prisoner myself, I knew what she was feeling. Yeah, she was nasty. The other one was good, another one, she was killed.
So she might have thought she was going to be raped.
Well, something. Yeah, it's quite possible. I mean, probably that's what they'd have done. The same, you know, been the other way around. But that was quite an amusing little time. It raised morale in the camp. Morale was always... Well, later on, after that operation, we got quite a few around Kajang. Because the locals, funny enough, realised that if they told us things, it helped them. We got rid of these people who were bullying them. And so that they came with information to the special branch. And this chap, Dedek Sowerby, who was a splendid officer, our special branch officer, he used to come. Every time his grey car arrived, the troops knew there was something going to happen.
Were you involved in any of the other elimination of enemy?
Yes, I commanded another setup when we got two.
Can you describe that one?
Well, that was easy. Sowerby arrived with his grey car. The moment the grey car came, the troops knew there was something on. And I organised a whole company's worth of troops in the camp, and what we did a cordon and search. We cordoned. He knew roughly where they were because he got information from the villagers, and we went out at 1:30 and we were back by 3 with two dead bodies. I mean, a force of say 100-130 against two doesn't give the two much chance. And what I did, I put two platoons in the cordon and advanced with one platoon.
What were these two enemy doing at the time?
I don't know. They were dead. I don't know what they were doing. They were probably coming in for food.
Do you know which years you were in Malaya?
Yeah, I do. 54, 56.
Well, that's all right. That'll be on record anyway. Were you and the troops happy in Malaya doing that job?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It got boring. But the troops, you see, they would rather be in the jungle, I'm sure, than in camp. Away from the sergeant major. You see, and they were all in little groups, cooking up for themselves. I mean, these boys came straight from Hampshire. They didn't have a clue.
Did you have any casualties on that big operation against the camp?
No, none.
Did you suffer casualties as a whole during the 2 years?
No. B Company did, yes. They had one officer killed. I've forgotten how many the battalion had, but not many.